Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Thanksgiving, we're grateful for a harvest big enough to feed us all and millions more. We're grateful for citizens who reach out to those who struggle and for neighbors in need, from neighbors in need to the strangers they've never met. We're grateful for working Americans who've given us the longest period of uninterrupted job creation on record and a prosperity that lifts our citizens. And we are grateful for one blessing in particular. The men and women of the United States military. They've worn proudly the uniform of our country. They have offered their lives in our defense. And each year, thousands more volunteer to join their noble ranks and to keep us safe. And so on this Thanksgiving, we keep their families and their loved ones in our prayers and in our thoughts. Thank you.
Okay. Now let's hear the pardon, if you don't mind.
So now I have a task, and that is to grant a full presidential pardon. May and Flower. They will be shortly flown to Disney World, where they will serve as honorary grand marshals for the Thanksgiving
All
Day
right.
parade.
Thank you very much, President Bush. Now, if you'd only grant a full presidential pardon, not to a turkey, but to Colonel Chisani, we'd know that a word that came out of your mouth had any sincerity. It's easy to grant a pardon to a turkey. It's all fun and games. But why don't you grant a pardon to the poor Marines who have been persecuted by Time Magazine, Jack Murtha, and now, of course, the U.S. military? Let me explain something to you listeners out there. Wounded soldiers are now being asked to give back their sign-on bonuses by the U.S. military. That's right. That's what they're getting as part of their Thanksgiving thanks. We found this story for you today. It's linked up on michaelsavage.com. And we were shocked to hear that the U.S. military is demanding that thousands of wounded service personnel give back signing bonuses because they can't serve out their commitments. So men and women who have lost arms, legs, eyesight, hearing, and can no longer serve are being told by George Bush's military, pay back some of that money. You think I'm making it up? One of them is a man named Jordan Fox. He gets his comfort in giving hundreds of boxes onto a truck in his town. And each box contains a care package that will be sent to a man or woman serving in Iraq. Jordan Fox was seriously injured when a roadside bomb blew up his vehicle. He was knocked unconscious. His back was seriously injured. He lost all vision in his right eye. A few months later, Fox was sent home. His injuries prohibited him from fulfilling 3 months of his commitment. A few days ago, he got a letter from the military demanding nearly $3,000 of his signing bonus back. He said, I try to do my best and serve my country. I was unfortunately hurt in the process. Now they're telling me they want their money back. It's a slap in the face for Fox's mother, Susan Wojcicki, who met with President Bush in Pittsburgh, PA last May. The president thanked her for starting Operation Pittsburgh Pride, which has sent approximately 4,000 care packages to the troops. He then sent her a letter expressing his concern over her son's injuries. So she cannot understand why the U.S. government would want the money back. And while the military man, her son, is unsure of his future, he's unwavering in his commitment to America. He said, I would do it all over again. I would do it all over again because I'm proud of the discipline I learned. I'm proud to have done something for my country. But Mr. Fox feels like he's already given enough. You see, he'll never be able to pursue his dream of being a police officer because of his wounds. and he can't believe he's being asked to return part of his $10,000 signing bonus. There it is, ladies and gentlemen. That's your Thanksgiving for you. So if you feel good for the turkey, that's all well and good. But how about feeling good for our wounded soldiers who are being told by the military to give back their bonuses? I have in my hand a fundraising letter I got from the National Republican Congressional Committee the other day, and in it is a request for money. It says no postage necessary if mailed in the United States, but it says your first-class stamp will save us much-needed funds. So I took the National Republican Congressional Committee request, and I wrote on it, 1, stop illegals, 2, deport illegals, 3, shrink spending, and 4, release Lieutenant Colonel Chesani. I crossed out the area where it says how much I want to give. I am not putting a stamp on the envelope, and I'm sending it back to the National Republican Congressional Committee. I suggest you do the same with the Democrats and the Republicans, because when it comes to America, I can tell you something that I've learned over the years in radio. When both parties agree on something, you can be sure that the American people are getting screwed. And they seem to both agree that we need illegal aliens. They seem to both agree that we need to spend more money than we have to spend on pork barrel spending under war bills. They seem to agree that we need to export jobs and not build jobs. See, both parties actually agree in principle on virtually everything. The only thing they squabble over, are things that really don't matter because there's no money attached to them. So on this Thanksgiving, I'd like to thank the troops who have served and are serving in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And I'd like to thank my audience for not catering to the radical extremist Muslims, both abroad and in America, who are trying to drive free speech off the air. And I'll have a lot more to tell you about that next week, right here on the Savage Nation, when you will be able to vote with your dollars and show the American people that there are more conservative listeners to the Savage Nation than there are radical Islamists, as represented by CAIR. When you cancel certain products, which I will tell you about next week, they will find out that there are more of you than there are the radical extremist Bund, the Islamic American Bund in America. What do you think about this topic? Well, I know you can't be happy about it, so please don't call me. We'll only get angry. Did you see the story today? By the way, if you think I made this up just for effect and I'm doing it for ratings, you're wrong. The article on the wounded soldier who must give back his bonus and the others who are being demanded to give back their bonus can be found on michaelsavage.com. How about this story? Top left lead on my website. Very important story. Now, the headline in the Washington Post reads this way. It says, UN to cut estimate of AIDS epidemic. Population with virus overstated by millions. Here's Michael Savage's headline. AIDS racketeers vastly hype numbers to get more dollars. Now, I've been calling them AIDS racketeers for as long as, well, I know what's going on inside the AIDS racket. I know it. I told you about this for over 15 years. I know that it's all a racket. It's all a racket, much like the global warming racket. And speaking of the global warming racket and the chief racketeer, the peasant avante of the global warming racket is Al Gore. In fact, Al Gore Leone is making more money than the head of any crime family ever made, and his global warming hype could make Al Gore the richest vice president in history. That's right. It used to be said that when the missionaries came to Hawaii, they came to do good, and they did very well indeed. The same is true of Al Gore. He claims to be doing good, which is questionable, but we know he's doing very well indeed. He's going to make over $100 million this year. I'll be right back.
Savage.
So, President Bush pardoned the turkey, but will not pardon the Marines who have been falsely accused. The soldiers who have lost eyes or hearing or legs are being told to give back their sign-on bonuses. And we learned finally that AIDS racketeers have vastly hyped the numbers to get more dollars. Now, I've been warning you about this for over 10 years. You got to remember who you're listening to. And I'm going to say it whether you like to hear it or not. My PhD is in epidemiology and nutrition from the University of California at Berkeley. I earned it in 1978. So I know more about this subject than anybody in commercial talk radio, probably more than anybody at NPR. I have warned you for years that the AIDS racket was a racket, much like the global warming racket is a money-generating racket for Al Gore and other gangsters, in my opinion. Here's the data that's come out. It says, having millions fewer people with a lethal contagious disease is good news. Some researchers, however, contend that persistent overestimates in the widely quoted UN reports, notice UN reports, same ones that were telling you about global warming, have long skewed funding decisions and obscured potential lessons about how to slow the spread of HIV. That's a loaded statement. Helen Epstein is an author, and she says there was a tendency towards alarmism, and that fit perhaps a certain fundraising agenda. Now, I want to tell you something about that. We're being told now that in Africa, AIDS is an out-of-control epidemic. But what you don't know is that the racketeers in Africa, the gangsters who run most African nations, have lumped malaria, tuberculosis, and even childbirth in with the AIDS disease itself. The diseases of AIDS itself, to be more specific. In fact, by the definitions as created by the corrupt United Nations, a pregnant woman meets all the standards for having AIDS, even if she doesn't have the HIV virus. It has to do with certain symptoms rather than an actual illness. And so, therefore, it's a way of milking the rich countries for more money so that the gangsters who run the African countries can rob us and go to brothels in Dusseldorf, for example. UN to cut estimates of AIDS epidemic. Well, this is long overdue. And, of course, you'll hear that it was a mistake, that there really is no reduction, and we need more money for AIDS. Rates are lower in East Africa and much lower in West Africa. Did you know that? In other words, the picture of the AIDS epidemic portrayed by the newer studies shows a massive concentration of infections in the southern third of Africa, with nations such as Swaziland and Botswana reporting as many as 1 in 4 adults infected with HIV. But HIV rates are lower in East Africa and much lower in West Africa. Why? Do you know why? Researchers are saying that the prevalence of circumcision, which slows the spread of HIV, and regional variations in sexual behavior are the biggest factors determining the severity of the AIDS epidemic in different countries and even within countries. Beyond Africa, AIDS is more likely to be concentrated among high-risk groups. Now, who are the high-risk groups? Injectable drug users, that means junkies, filthy, dirty junkies. They now call them injectable drug users. Sex workers, they're known as prostitutes or whores or hookers. And gay men, who you know to be homosexual men. Now, why would homosexual men likely to have more of the HIV virus than your grandmother? Well, I think you can figure it out. I think you can put two and two together, even though you've seen only the sanitized version of the kind of sex that homosexual men engage in. The fact of the matter is, it is a behavior that no religion on earth condones. And the reason no religion on earth condones it is pretty evident to those of us who don't engage in it. But those involved in this kind of behavior are rather fanatical in their belief that it's a wholesome way to behave between people. And consequently, they pillory anybody who dares say, don't do it. It's not healthy for you. Of course, the HIV epidemic would show that that's a correct statement. But since when does reason ever play out in American politics? What the pilgrims really ate is another topic on michaelsavage.com, and we can do that, but I don't think it's too interesting to read that they ate more than turkey. We have a worrisome problem on our hands, and that is the economy. Truthfully, underneath the surface, it's very worrisome. I watched CNBC before I went on the air tonight, and there was some clown with a tie on, a bow tie, who I frankly would like to have wrung his neck, talking to some girl with big brown eyes who they say is some great star at CNBC, somebody with a long syllabic last name. I don't remember her name. But he was glowing about how he left America with his wife and children and has moved to Singapore, and how he's dumping U.S. dollars. And he's advising people to sell off the U.S. dollar because it's overvalued. And I was saying, this man typifies everything evil in the United States of America financial markets. Here is a man criticizing everybody in the government for mismanaging the economy. And yet here's a man selling off dollars, recommending that we break the dollar, shorting the dollar, and leaving the country. I felt like reaching through the screen and wringing his scrawny little neck and taking his bow tie and shoving it down his throat. But then, of course, I only felt like doing that because I knew I couldn't do it. Garcia and Rodriguez cracked top 10 list for most popular surnames in America. That's correct. Thanks to George Bush and Al Corleone and the Clintons and the invasion of the nation snatchers, Garcias are catching up to the Joneses. That's correct. The number of Hispanics living in the United States grew by 58% in the 1990s to nearly 13% of the total population. And so as a result of the greed of those at the top who want cheap workers, we now are seeing a change in the demographics of the United States of America. Now, if anybody says this, of course, they will be boycotted by the so-called anti-discrimination groups, which are really nothing but gangsters in bow ties. That's what they're doing. Just as the AIDS racketeers are really gangsters with bow ties, who pretend all along that they were helping people with AIDS. If you actually investigate it, where most of that money goes, it goes up their nose and down the tailpipes of Gulfstream jets. Boise, Idaho. Justin, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hey, Michael, I want to thank you. Today I was reading the newspaper, and I read that article about the UN and the inflated AIDS figures, and I knew that I could count on you. I knew that you would speak on that tonight and tell the truth about that, and I said to myself, I can't wait because Dr. Savage is going to talk about that, and that's something that a lot of people don't realize. For example, that the fraudulent science of the UN, the fraudulent medical philosophies of it, such as in the World Health Organization, were instrumental in also crafting China's abortion policy in the early 70s. And they are.
Well, I don't want to get into the abortion policy of China, but the AIDS racket has long been talked about right here on the Savage Nation by your good doctor.
Savage.
$30 million Americans cannot be wrong. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. 33 million of you have gone on to michaelsavage.com since last February. That's right. I'll repeat the number. This is a number that the media refuses to acknowledge. 33 million of you have gone on my website. 30 million of you have said, Michael, please leave radio and run for office. 3 million of you have said, don't leave radio and don't run for office. Now, I got to tell you something. You control the outcome of the next election. You do. The independents of America, listen to me. I'm not saying I have 30 million people a day. Don't get me wrong. But I would say over the course of a week, they claim the numbers are 8 to 10 million. My guess is, since rating systems are flawed and imprecise, I would suggest it's double that. And that's why I think 30 million is accurate. So 30 million of you listen to this show every day, and yet a few faxes from a Muslim front group, a pressure group called CAIR, have encouraged several advertisers to leave this show. Now, others have stepped into the fold and doubled the spending. Next week, I'm going to give you the names of those who have catered to the Islamists, because if you don't fight CAIR now, and you do not expose those behind CAIR now, they will come for the next show one at a time. Today it's me, tomorrow it's the next guy. Eventually you'll be on four knees praying to Mecca. And if you want to have your women in burqas, and if you want to be catering to radical Islamists who are now in bed with homosexual radical groups such as Media Matters. You see, Media Matters was created by Hillary Clinton. We have that on tape. She boasts about creating Media Matters. Media Matters is run by a fanatical homosexual radical who hates Michael Savage. He has actually chosen to join those who, if they had power, would collapse brick walls on him. It just shows you that liberalism is a mental disorder. But now you have to exert your financial pressure upon America. And you've got to say, finally, once and for all, I'm going to vote with my dollars. Now, I'm not going to give you the names of these advertisers today, but I will after Thanksgiving. And you're going to go and you're going to show them by canceling their products that there are more of you than there are the few people with fax machines at the radical front group for radical extremist Islam called CAIR. So let's go back to the stories here. Here's today's Old York Times. As security improves, Baghdad starts to exhale. Really? Gee, I thought things were doom and gloom in Iraq. Well, here we see a bride and a groom dressed for their wedding photos last week in Baghdad. I don't know what got into Pinchy Sulzberger of the New York Times. Maybe he's away for Thanksgiving in Switzerland somewhere, making sure that his bank accounts are still operational for the day he has to leave the country. But what? There must be some new publisher there showing that things are good in Iraq is sacrilege to the New York Times. Oh, but wait, here are the gloom and doom stories. On Broadway, gloom hangs over holidays. Gloom hangs over holidays. You have to have doom and gloom. Now, why is there gloom on Broadway? Strikes between producers and stagehands, blah, blah, blah. Well, my hope is that the TV writers stay out for a year, the news writers go out for a year, and the theaters close for a year. If only the porno industry went on strike, the country has a chance to recover from the filth and disease that has invaded our mind. If only there was a strike for at least a year of the TV writers and the others, the news writers in particular, the country could actually come back. It could replenish itself from the filth. Decline of the tenure track raises concerns at colleges. You know what tenure is at colleges, don't you? You have any idea why the campuses are swelled with losers? It's called tenure. And what's the example they give? Oh, they give an example of some another loser. Blah, 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 blah. Citigroup leads Dow down, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, the economy worries me a little bit. I don't know, sell dollars. How can I sell dollars? I mean, sell dollars and buy euros and buy yen and buy the sterling silver, buy sterling, buy yen, buy the euro, they say, and dump the dollar. I'm going to sell off my own country's currency. What do they want to see, these vermin in bow ties? What are these vermin in bow ties who busted the country down, who sold us out to the communist Chinese and everyone else they could find, like cheap prostitutes on the lowest street in town? What do they want to happen to this rotten? You know, these people get me sick. That scrawny-necked vermin who was on that show with that woman with the syllabic last name. I don't remember her name. He made me ill. I'm selling the dollar. I moved my family to Singapore. I couldn't believe how confident he was in himself. There's no loyalty from these vermin on Wall Street, is there? If they could shut America down and take out another buck out of the system, they probably would. But then there are those of us who don't see it that way. There are those of us who are not going to shut the lights off and leave, let me tell you. But if I had the power, if I had the power, I would stop these people like a virus, because they're viruses. Make no mistake about it. I'd shut this virus down tomorrow. And I could do it. I would have the power to do it. The president has very wide powers to control the vermin on Wall Street. He could do it. He could stop the currency speculation. He could do an awful lot that he's not doing. You know, right now he's waving a big carrot and then holding out a small carrot against Iran. He's a phony through and through. All we've been hearing about is Iran. We're going to stop them with the centrifuges. So we send four aircraft carrier groups to the Gulf. And what do? Nothing. Nothing. Burning up fuel. They're burning up fuel. They're doing nothing. What are the aircraft carriers for? What do you build them for, Mr. Bush? What are you training these young men to fly F-A-18s if you don't use them? Why are you sending Mr. Smith's son into a back alley in Baghdad to get his eye blown out and then demanding that he give back his sign-on bonus, Mr. Bush? Why are you persecuting Lieutenant Colonel Chassani, Mr. Bush, when you could end this? You could take Jack Murtha and put him in a court-martial. You could take Jack Murtha and put him in a court. You could take Time Magazine's Tim McGurk and put him in jail for sedition, Mr. Bush. You have that power, Mr. Bush. And that's why I say, I am taking this request for donations from the Republican Congressional Committee, and I am not putting a first-class stamp on the envelope. I'm letting them pay for it. And I am inserting the pledge form with not so much as 1 cent in it, And I have written on it, 1, stop illegals, 2, deport illegals, 3, shrink spending, and 4, release Lieutenant Colonel Chesani. And that is what they're going to get from me. Not 1 cent until the Republicans act on behalf of the American people and the United States military instead of on behalf of themselves. It's one man's opinion. It's a free country. 1-800-449-8. I forget my number. I have no idea what the number is. Look at these wonderful callers. So he pardoned the turkey. You getting ready for Thanksgiving out there? What is today already? Normal people are on the road. Normal people are on holiday. Normal people are in transit. Normal people are on the way to relatives. Normal people are looking forward to being with relatives. Normal people are not listening to the radio right now. Anyone listening to the show is not normal. Welcome to the club. I think there are more non-normal people than normal because the word norm, of course, has very little meaning in the world that we live in. If it ever had any meaning at all, I couldn't believe about this mega church thing. Basically, it's a media church. It doesn't exist. There is no home for it. But the operators of the mega church, which is a media driven thing, you know, like hail this and hail me, turns out that in addition to making a fortune based upon biblical preachings, one of the pastors has an illegitimate child with his brother's wife, and the illegitimate child is a preacher in his own mega church. I think, well, it's all in the family. The good news there is that they're keeping it within the family. You got to look at the bright side. At least the illegitimate child, who we used to call a certain name when I was a child, you can't use that name anymore. At least it turned out to be, he kept it within the family. You got to look at the positive. He didn't go outside the family for his sexual gratification. Now, I know it violates all the biblical prohibitions that he preaches against, but the positive side is that his illegitimate son is now working with him in the church. So there's a benefit to this kind of behavior in the sense that it's all in the family. Oh, my God. But you have to ask, I mean, is this new or is this old? Did this go on forever? A lot of people say, come on, this has always been going on. I don't know anymore. I don't know whether it's a result of greater exposure or it's really changed. I can't tell. But I do know that things were so bad in the church a couple hundred years ago that they actually had prostitution rings in the back of the churches in order to bring in money. I know you find that shocking. I didn't say last year. I didn't say 100 years ago. I'm saying in Europe. I think it was in the 1700s. The church had gone through such bad times. They had all these huge cathedrals with no one in them. They needed to generate money somehow, so they brought in hookers for the rear of the church. And they ran a little business in the back. Now, Jesus was long gone. God rest his soul. Now, he would have said, you know, get rid of the money changers in the temple in his day. I could just imagine what he would have said if he had seen the prostitution rings in the back of the church in the 1700s. So, I don't know, maybe this is not so... you know, not so new, all of this stuff. Who knows? I will have my turkey on Thursday. I will have my potatoes on Thursday. I will have my stuffing on Thursday. I will have my wine or beer on Thursday, as will Teddy. And then it will be Friday. You see, that's life. In the morning, the sun rises. You know, every day now, I have to get up and say to myself, this brainwashing on global warming is so profound. And yet, my common sense tells me it's all hype. Now, forget the fact that most of the science is controversial on this issue. In fact, a goodly percentage of the science proves beyond a reasonable doubt that there is no man-generated global warming. And I can give you one quick study. It just came out last year. And this was an international team of climatologists and geologists, an international team, mind you. And the report was published by the UN, mind you, but it didn't make it to your local paper. They drilled down 1.2 miles into the core of the Arctic. Think of a drill going down 1.2 miles, and they bring up a core of ice that's that deep in the Earth. And that means it's very old ice. And the date of that old ice is, God knows, a million years ago. I don't know how long ago, whatever, a long time ago, long before Larry King was on television. In fact, probably long before Larry King was born, that's how far back it goes, which means it predates the time of Moses. And they pulled up this core of ice, and they looked at the remnants of the DNA of plants and animals that had roamed the earth during that ancient period. And by looking at that remnants of the plant and animal life, the scientists discovered that global temperatures on the earth at that time were actually much higher than they are today. Now, if I give you this common sense piece of data, why are you not reading it in your local paper? Answer, because most of the editors of papers are like the editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, who walks around in black shirts and black pants, stressing his muscles, and yet behind his back, people call him an adolescent bully. And by the way, an ignorant adolescent bully, because most of the newspaper editors are ignorant adolescent bullies. They certainly don't read the data. And so therefore, if global warming is hyped scientifically, hyped rather without looking at the science, I can tell you now using common sense something else. I am a boater, and I use tide charts to go out on my boat. I have to read the tide charts in order to go out, because if the water is too low, I can't go out on my boat because the channel is too narrow and I don't want to dredge up mud and get it into my engines, right? So I read the charts and I try to go out at a mid tide up to a high tide. I try to come back on a higher tide rather than a mud tide, right? It's not that it goes down to zero, but it goes down to about 4 or 5 feet in the channel where I am, because we were screwed by the dredging company who was supposed to dig to 7 feet. But since the idiots who pay for it don't have guts or brains, they let the thieving dredger get away with 4 feet. But it's still not down to mud yet. But nevertheless, I read tide charts. And guess what? In all the years I've been in the San Francisco Bay, I have not seen the tides change by so much as 1 centimeter. The height of the water in the San Francisco Bay has not risen or fallen above or below the estimates of the tide charts by so much as 1 centimeter. Not 1 centimeter. So my common sense when I go out, and I'm a biologist by training and by instincts, the seals look happy, the birds look happy, the water looks happy. The water is at exactly the same level it's been at, God knows, for a very, very long period of time. There's no change whatsoever on the planet, none whatsoever. In fact, every November, it's the same as every November out here in Northern California. The days are kind of beautiful and warm and sunny, but not too hot. And the nights are absolutely fabulously cold. Cold meaning in the 40s, sometimes more hovering 49, 50, which I love to sleep in. It's the perfect temperature for sleeping. In other words, you don't need heat, and you could sleep in flannel pajamas under 3 covers with your head sticking out and your nose getting cold, but you don't actually get cold enough where you have to shut the windows and turn on the heat. So in other words, we have the same climate we've had since I moved out here in 1974. Now you say, well, what does that tell you? It tells me a lot. Like common sense tells me nothing's changing, but every day you read this propaganda. And as Goebbels, the propaganda minister for Hitler, warned us, or actually boasted, if you tell a big lie long enough, it becomes the truth. So as Al Gore continues to go around the country, disseminating the big lie that man is destroying the earth through global warming, the big lie is becoming the truth in the minds of the soft-minded. And yet it is making Al Gore the richest vice president in history. But because we have a media consisting of ignorant, bullying adolescents, he gets away with virtual murder. Now, is the press beginning to see through Al Gore's global warming scam? Not any more than they saw through the AIDS racketeering scam until 30 years into the epidemic. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Now, I think I'm going to go to some Thanksgiving story now. I'm sick and tired of politics. It's heartbreaking. I think I'll talk about Thanksgiving with a vegetarian relative. I think that's an interesting topic I've just come up with. Because I know many of you are going to have to suffer through some lacto-ovo vegetarian who's going to act holier than thou as you're, you know, slopping down the turkey and gravy and enjoying every bite. Oh, no, go right ahead. I just don't indulge myself. It's very much like the ex-drinkers, the AA people, who act very, very beneficent or benevolent towards you as you have a drink. Oh, no, thanks. That's fine. Don't let me stop you. But you know they're putting you down if you're enjoying a drink and they don't, because they're a drunk and you're not. Well, it's the same when I say Thanksgiving with a vegetarian relative. It borders on the exact same mentality. Whereas you feast on turkey and whatever else is there. No, I'll have a few of those potatoes. There's no milk in that or cheese, is there? Well, how the hell do you think I make the potato? What do you think is in the potato? Well, then I can't eat it. Or how about the green pea? Well, there's no lacto in there. Yeah, I put something in there. No, I can't eat that either. What can you eat, you freak? And they do it basically to show you that they're superior to you, the vegetarian relative. I don't know why they even come to dinner. They just ought to go to a tofu turkey dinner somewhere and leave you alone. Why even come? Why make everybody uncomfortable, is my opinion. They shouldn't even be there. You know, if you're going to go there to a celebration, eat the food that's there or don't come. For example, I made my point. That's I don't give any more examples. That said it like it is. Do you have any, what are your vegetarian relative horror stories out there for Thanksgiving? You have none? Then play the train. I'm going home. We'll go to a best of. No, let me just hear the train. Get the train for a minute. It'll get me into the state of mind I need to be in to do the next hour. Nothing's worked for me so far today. I tried just, there you go. There you go. And I'm getting into it now. And New York, New York, New York. Circa early 1950. Nope, can't get into the mood. Now that my mother's been dead these 4 years, I can't. It's more 5 years already? How time flies. Happened around this. That's eerie. I don't like the cold weather for that reason. Yeah, when the days are short, I got the call. Your mother, oh, God. And then 1970, when I was swimming on a beach in Hawaii, your father died. That was a nice one. It was one of the nicest days of my life. The first day I actually enjoyed being in Hawaii. I hated it living there in a way. It was hard for me being. It's boring after a while, you know, and anywhere that's paradise, you know, isn't. And most people live, they don't go to the beach. I mean, they have their lives to lead. They don't want to get skin cancer. And how many times can you lay on a beach? So I went out to the Leeward Shore, green water, gorgeous, big rolling waves. Spent the day with friends. Got a little call when I came back. You know, had to fly like 70,000 hours back to New York to the funeral. That was fun. Then the mother, but that's life. It's the way of all flesh. So they're waiting up there. I know they're waiting in the next world. I'm sure of it. And you say, well, how can you be sure of it? Well, how can you not be sure of it? Are you telling me with this infinite universe, it's not possible that our deceased relatives are not waiting for us in the next world? Can you say that with absolute certainty? And if so, how can you prove it? Prove it to me. Let's go the other way.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
All right. Can the music already? Welcome to the Savage Nation. So anyway, open the mail today. Go to the mailbox. Pull out all the. They're starting already with the circulars. This is the time of year I hate the most. You got to throw out every day all this glossy. You know, I mean, there's a part of me that's still, you know, a conservationist. So anyway, one of the brochures that I got was called a dog catalog. Right? It says I'm a dog lover. I look through it. Normally I throw them out. I hate every day these for the Christmas holidays. You know, whatever. So I'm looking through it, $100 for a bedding for a dog, whatever, you know the kind of stuff. Hey, all right, we got an affluent society. A lot of people don't want to have children. They just want orgasms and shoes. So they have a dog or a cat. I have a family, so I feel okay to have a dog. I raise children. I had dogs when I didn't, when I had children. I had a dog before I had children. I had a dog when I was a child. I've always had a dog as a companion. So I'm looking through it, and I'm the cute dogs and the name with the ears. And lo and behold, I get to the back, and they have memorial plaques already for dead dogs, and I get sick. It set off my whole day. It got me so depressed. And it got me into that whole cycle again of what's it all about, you know, Joey. I mean, these personalized, weather-durable memorials create a tranquil place of remembrance. Granite photo memorials. Now I'm drinking my coffee, and I'm reading the Gracie, 1995 to 03. In our hearts forever, and part of me starts to, like, go to pieces here. This unique custom-designed memorial captures the love you shared with your pet in a way that withstands time, exquisitely crafted. Blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking of the dogs that have died in my life now. And I'm thinking of Snowy now laying there in the ground with the bones, with the decay, with the bugs. Now I turn to the next page. In memory of a faithful friend and companion, Ossie, 1992 to Daisy, 1985 to 1994. And I said, oh my God, faithful friend stone. Reconstituted stone with personalized hand, 89.95. Breed slate. If tears could be stone, reconstituted with personalization, $130. If tears could build a stairway, here we go. Next page. Now I'm up to the dog lamps, then the dog pajamas. So I'm going to pass the memorials. But meanwhile, there's a certain macabre sense that I'm back already now with the memorials again, saying, let me look at that again. Wait a minute. I got to go through this again with another pet? How many? But then you say, wait a minute, why are you? You're thinking more about the pets that died than your mother and your father and your brother and your brother-in-law and all everyone else has died around you. Why are you thinking about your dog in the memorials? I don't know. I don't know why. How do I know why? What do I know why? I mean, because I don't know why. I'm anthropomorphizing. I think of Snowy, young Snowy, the last dog out of the shelter years ago. Lassie, Lassie, jumping over the boards and looked like the movie Lassie, a little, you know, a miniature one. Lassie, Lassie. I was thinner. I was younger. The hair was darker. Lassie, Snowy, over the boards, running through the woods, tongue hanging out, getting the blackberries off the bushes. Then the last scene, click, click, shriveled up like a tubercular with the last glint of light in her eye laying there on the ground. Horrors. So you're next. In other words, it's not the dog that you're really thinking about. It's you. Yourself, in other words, it's me. So in other words, that's called maudlin. In other words, I'm getting maudlin about my own demise. And I shouldn't do this to you on Thanksgiving, but what the heck, I'm that kind of guy. I thought I would share. No, I tend towards depression, I'll admit it. I'm like Abraham Lincoln in that way. When you actually have to deal with the weight of the world and you see the scum of the earth in this country and what they're doing to it, you know, at a certain point, you know, you start to get a little overwhelmed by the scum of the earth in this country were not arrested immediately. In my day, there'd be guys, 6'6", 6'7", cops, they'd break in doors, they'd bust them over the head with nightsticks, they'd drag them out. As they're screaming ACLU, they'd drag the ACLU out by the neck, too, and throw them in a cell. They'd rubber hose them in the back. And we controlled, the country was controlled better. We were all afraid of the police then. Consequently, it was a safer place. Your grandmother could go shopping in Little Italy and leave packages on the streets in the backseat of her car. We know there were gangsters, but they watched the car. They didn't want crime in their neighborhood. And that was a microcosm of America. We knew that many of the politicians were crooks, but they watched out for the grandmothers. They watched out for the girls. Now, because of the breakdown in society, nobody's watching out for anybody anymore. So, yeah, it starts to get to you after a while, you know. And that's what I say. I mean, what are you going to do? That's it. You do the best you can. You send your emails and your letters. And Dreamwalker harness, quilted cover seats, lightweight versatile ramp, $89. Car seats double as boosters and lookouts, $74.95. I'm actually looking for, look at this, therapeutic heat in a seat cover for a spoiled dog. It's unbelievable to me. Your pet may like the concrete and tile, but it's bad for his bones. Oh, I hit a wrong knob. And what came up on my screen here? God, something came up on my tele screen. Close. It'll close down the entire screen with all the callers next. I knew it. I got a new engineer back there. Candy for dogs. Never give it to them. I went somewhere the other day with the dog. Oh, the bank. They said, you want a biscuit for the dog? I said, no, he doesn't eat garbage. He doesn't eat any junk food. So the guy's diplomatic, a young guy. They taught him what to say to troublesome customers. Oh, that's good. He'll live long. You hear this? After offering him something that would make him live short, and I say, don't give it to me. He says, oh, that's good. You know, everything's PR today. If you know it will hurt the dog, why offer him a biscuit if it's full of garbage? Reversible fleece jacket, $59.95. Charm bracelet for your dog. Happy Holly Dots to you. Dog warm insulate coat. It's a dog made for hunting, running in the woods. What are you giving him a coat, turning him into a Democrat for? Look at the things they put on. They look like liberals from Marin County. Coats in the summertime, warmers for their poor little bones. It's not cute. It's disgusting. Actually, some of this is so indulgent. It's disgusting garbage. I don't mind getting them something that they need, but what's with the cuddle mat? Canine cooler therapeutic pad. Tile and cement floors are cool, but cruelly hard on joints, causing calluses and worsening existing health conditions. Yeah, I got to worry about my dog now with arthritis. I never saw anything like this. And yet I know many of us do. The other night I was driven to a dinner by a friend of mine who owns a detective agency. And he had a driver with him, a small guy, about 6'7", weighed 350 pounds, ex-military. The guy was as big as the first Volkswagen I owned. But this big man has like a bunch of little dogs, and he says, I have a homeopathic doctor for one and another doctor for that. So don't think people don't buy this stuff. Luxury crate mattress, cages, beds, nest inventions, memory foam pad, I don't know, bolster bed. How could there be so many things for dogs? Well, because people are not having children anymore, that's why. They don't have them for whatever the reason. So they're raising dogs and cats. We know that. And there's nothing wrong with it. Everyone has love in them. And the animal brings out love in you. That's the truth. After everything goes in a marriage, the only thing left is the dog that brings out still a desire to touch something with a beating heart. Otherwise, you know, what's left? You'd be like Ichabod Crane in your house. After a certain number of years, you know, you don't touch. You're touching the dog. All the love that's left, the remnant, the shadow of love that's left in the house, it goes into the cat or the dog. At least it's a remnant of humanity left there with the animals. So they serve a good purpose, that's all. I mean, you got to look at it that way. Poochie, come here, Poochie. But those memorials, they got... I got to go back one more time. It's like having a tooth that when you inhale, it hurts. You know, you suck air on it, you get a migraine from it. It's the same thing going back to same page 39. These personalized, weather-durable memorials create a tranquil place of remembrance. Faithful friend stone. In memory of a faithful friend and companion. There we go already. My pal plaque. Breed slate. If tears could stone. Reconstituted stone with personalization handcrafted in the USA. Thank God it's not made in China out of human kidneys. 1 inch thick. Please specify 1 to 3 lines up to 18 letters. Sorry, express delivery not available. Personalized if tears could stone, $130. If tears could build a stairway and memories a lane, I'd walk right up to heaven. And bring you home again. I'll be right back. Savage. So I was talking about getting, you know, a flyer in the mail, a glossy book with the dog thing, flipping through with the mats, the collars, and you get down now to the memorials. And it got me like depressed, Daisy, Stairway to Heaven, in memory of an old friend. I couldn't take it. I buried one already 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Now there's another one is four. I'm afraid I enjoy him for another second because I'm already seeing him in the ground. I mean, you know, it's like, whoa, kaleidoscopic mind here. But I'd like to read something in memory of all the military men who have laid down their lives so I can be before you today on the Savage Nation. All kidding aside, I really would like to read something in memory of the brave men who have died so that I could speak here to fight Islamofascism, for example, and the enemy within. And this is called To an Athlete Dying Young from the Collected Poems of A.E. Housman. The time you won your town the race, we cheered you through the marketplace. Man and boys stood cheering by, and home we brought you shoulder high. Today the road all runners come, shoulder high we bring you home and set you at your threshold down, townsmen of a stiller town. Smart lad to slip betimes away from fields where glory does not stay, and early though the laurel grows, it withers quicker than the rose. Eyes the shady night has shut, cannot see the record cut, and silence sounds no worse than cheers after earth has stopped the ears. Now you will not swell the rout of lads that wore their honors out. Runners whom renown outran, and the name died before the man. So set before its echoes fade, the fleet foot on the sill of shade, and hold to the low lintel up, the still defended challenge cup. And round that early laureled head will flock to gaze the strengthless dead, and find unwithered on its curls the garland briefer than a girl's. A. E. Housman, To an Athlete Dying Young, in honor of all of the brave men who have given their lives so that we can enjoy the freedom of this broadcast on the Savage Nation, even though the enemies within are trying to shut the show down. They will not win. At the end, they're going to lose. They don't know it. They think that they see victory right now. But very, very soon, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CAIR, will find out very soon that they're living in America, not in Syria. And now on to the callers on the Savage Nation. 1-800-449-8255. Sacramento, Nate, you're on the program. What's on your mind?
Yes, Michael. Thank you for being our Delta 32 gene protector against liberalism, the plague of liberalism. I have a little.
Well, liberalism has permitted Islamofascists to function in America under the guise of being civil rights groups. Make no mistake about it. Liberalism has metastasized way beyond a mere joke. It's now killing freedom of speech in this country. Make no mistake about it. Liberalism is now feeding outright fascism.
Right. I agree. And also, I have a little dog that I love, and I think one reason we miss them so much is that we control them their whole lives, and we don't know. I don't know if my dog's going to be with me in heaven. I hope the believing relatives and family will be there, but I know
you want to hear something interesting, and I don't know which writer wrote this. If someone knows, please call the Savage Nation. He said that in the next world, whatever that concept may be for the average listener, the animals that we had on this earth are the people, and we're their pets, and how we treated them on this earth is how they treat us in that world. I thought that was neat. I like that.
If that's the case, I can't wait.
I don't know whether it was John Steinbeck, I don't know, or Hemingway. I think it was Steinbeck, if I'm not mistaken. He loved his dog. Remember he wrote Travels with Charlie? Everyone forgot that, but all of the little men have copied that book now. That was a fun book in its day. Remember, through the Sea of Cortez, blah, 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 in the trailer. But that was a different age. It was a different time when guys like Steinbeck were writing. Hard-drinking, hard-living men who understood reality, as opposed to what we have today, the television guys, and everyone trying to look cute and intelligent and smart and perfect and girly talk. It's awful. Just awful. Awful. Did you like the poem "To an Athlete Dying Young" by A.E. Housman? Did anyone like it? Raise your hand if you thought that was a good memorial. No, that didn't go over. All right, I won't read it again. I love that poem. I discovered it in college when I was 18. Then I read everything Housman ever wrote. Then I read all about Housman, and he was a very dark character. He would wear black, all black, on his birthday because he didn't like the fact that he had been born. I mean, all right, that kind of guy, you know. That's the kind of guy he was, a dour, unhappy Englishman. So what are you going to do? There are people like that. And we go in and out of that. Dogs. You want to talk about dogs? Let's go to Chicago. Anna, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Mr. Savage. I love your show. I wanted to tell you you asked vegetarian horror stories, and I'll do you one better. I have a kosher vegetarian horror story for you.
No. Kosher vegetarian wedding, I understand you went to?
Yes, that's exactly right. It was.
Wait a minute. Let me see if I got this right. A kosher vegetarian wedding. Instead of chopped liver, you had what? Chopped slivers of tofu?
I'm not sure I could even identify a lot of the stuff that we ate.
Instead of stuffed derma, what did you have? Unstuffed derma?
It was the sad thing was that the guests, as you know, and I understand you're Jewish as well, we're people that like to have a good meal at a celebration, and people had to go eat after the wedding because not only was the food not filling and it wasn't very good.
Well, don't feel bad. I went to a wedding with people who are a totally different religion in a very upscale location. I had to get a pizza on the way home. It was so exquisite and so effete that they served next to nothing. And on the way home, I had to stop at a Domino's or whatever it was and grab a pizza in the car with the tuxedo. In other words, everything was so minimalist in Northern California that people were sitting there staring at empty plates most of the night. I'm not making this up. We could not believe it. 3 hours later, we were going into hypoglycemic attacks, and we had to stop at a pizza parlor. So it's crazy what goes on today. So you didn't like the kosher vegetarian wedding?
I did not. And nobody who was there liked it. People were actually
Did the groom have enough strength to break the glass under his foot, or he didn't have enough energy to do that because of the food?
Energy, I guess. I don't know where it came from. Not from the food, definitely.
Well, maybe he keeled over on the glass and broke it from fainting. Who knows?
Savage.
The Savage Nation. Let's move it along here. Let's go to the callers now. Let's see what the temperature of the nation actually is in this pre-Thanksgiving show. Canton, Ohio. Bob, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Thank you, Dr. Savage. You're a really enlightenment to me, a wonderful person. I think you're a Moses, a Jesus, and a prophet, and a rabbi all rolled into one, and you are a light in the darkness. As a youth, I had a pretty tough youth. But I was filling prescriptions kind of parallel to what you did when I was 14.
Oh, yeah, they let you work the counter, huh?
Well, yeah, the druggist was there for 60 years. He started to lose his eyesight. He would get me to verify the prescription against the bottle. And pretty soon I thought, well, both of us are not needed, so I did it, and he verified the work.
Isn't that funny? See, in those days, a 14-year-old kid who was intelligent could do a job like that. Today, a pharmacist can't even do a job like that. He's probably impaired on the drugs he's selling.
They're pre-counting prescriptions out. The pills in today's bottles, it surprised me the other night. They don't even have to count them because I think the doctors and the pharmaceuticals are working together on that. One other thing, Dr. Savage, I called Chuck Schumer's office the other day. He in Durbin and the different ones. I think he is a Jewish imposter. And that's what I told his office. You know, there's a lot of Christian young soldiers dying over there to help have a presence near Israel. And Schumer criticizes them and Murtha. And I really can't think that, you know, there's nothing orthodox about him. He's a schmuck. I told his office I thought so. I think
he's a schmuck. I mean, I wouldn't comment on his religion, but I think he's one of the great imposters of all time. Schumer gets me sick. Not only on this issue, but on many issues. Although I agreed with him on one, he did call the show and come on the air with me, to his credit, to try to stop the Dubai ports deal, if you remember.
Well, I did admire him for that. But Durbin and him, I think, is in the same ballpark. And there's a lot of sacrifices going on, and I think we need.
Yeah, but if you want to talk about religious affiliation, Murtha is not a Jewish man and a former Marine, and here he is stabbing the Marines in the back. I don't think it's about religion. I think it's about dollars and politics, my friend. But look, I appreciate you're in agony over this country. You don't know which way to turn or who to blame. Believe me, I know what you're saying, Bob. And thank you for the kind compliments about me. Tom in St. Louis, welcome to the Savage Nation. You're next up.
Thank you, Dr. Savage. I just wanted to thank you for that poem. It was awesome. I have three children in the military. One of them is in Iraq right now. And I want to invite all your callers to leave an empty space at their Thanksgiving table to remember those people who can't be home with us.
Well, trust me, I know what you're talking about, Tom. It's heartbreaking because they're not home with you.
Yeah.
They're not home with you, but Tom, I read that poem for you. I hope it... You know, look, mine was a little, you know, bleak. It was a little bleak, and I hope to God you don't, you know, ever have to go there, you know. I pray the day that they return to your dinner table. Thank you for the call, my friend, and thanks for the contribution. Oh, God, what shall I do now? How do you pull the show back up from here? It's not a, you know, here we entering Thanksgiving, 2007. Shall I read from Dickens, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times? You want me to read from that? Because it is the best of times and the worst of times. You know, it was a time of plenty. I'm going to get that during the next break. I have it somewhere in my vast Savage library. That's right. I'm an anachronism. I actually have books here in the library. Books. B-O-O-K-S. They were things that were printed before Bill Gates came along. Books. And... the reason I like them is I have yellow tags in some of them where I can immediately find things. What could you do with a digital Bible on it when you're trying to pray over a grave? Can you get out a computer? Are we going to go to funerals in the future now with Blackberries and do prayers? Oh, God. I'm really in a rotten mood. I don't know what it is. I'm in a rotten mood. Here it is. Look how I flip my Bible open. Proverbs number 9. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I cannot believe this. You know, there used to be a joke that the French took that, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and said the fear of the police is the beginning of wisdom. In America, the fear of the ACLU is the beginning of wisdom has become the watchword to show you how sick our politicians are, that they're afraid of a pervert with a pockmarked face because he has money and he sues them. I'd straighten them out. You give me the power, I'd straighten out that ACLU in about 30 days. 30 days, those rats would be on a Gulf Stream to Switzerland with what they robbed out of this country. I'd give them 30 days to get out of the country with their assets. That's what I would do to them. But then again, I'm only a talk show host. That's why I'm a talk show host and not a politician, because I would actually do something. Men do not despise a thief if he steal to satisfy his soul when he is hungry. You hear that? Uh-huh. Proverbs. You don't know that was in the Bible, the Proverbs. They were pretty smart guys. Men do not despise a thief if he steal to satisfy his soul when he is hungry. That's true. You read of a man who stole a loaf of bread because his children were hungry. You don't despise him. But it says next, but if he be found, he must restore sevenfold. He must give all the substance of his house. You got to read the whole thing. He that committeth adultery with a woman lacketh understanding. He doeth that would destroy his own soul. For jealousy is the rage of a man, and he will not spare in the day of vengeance. I don't understand that. Don't call me an interpret for me. Some of it I don't understand. To keep thee from the evil woman, from the smoothness of the alien tongue. Ooh. See, again, the old Jewish guys were afraid of women, I think. No, cover her hair, get her away from me. Why? Well, she's beautiful, that's why. Okay, so you don't want to look at her? To keep thee from the evil woman, from the smoothness of the alien tongue, lust not after her beauty in thy heart, neither let her captivate thee with her eyelids. Well, who should you look at, your brother Murray? What are you supposed to look lust after if not the woman? What are you going to lust after? Milton there? What are you? Lust not after her beauty in thy heart? Who then are you lust after if there's a guy single out there and all he did was pick olives all day and stave off Philistines? What should he do in his spare time? Is what I ask myself. See, a lot of it I don't understand. All these prohibitions, my God. This is worse than the rules of engagement for the U.S. Marines in Iraq. You talk about rules of engagement. You know, you could interpret the Bible as a book of a rules of engagement for life. If you pick this thing up in the morning and you go through the whole thing, you may as well stay in bed. But even in bed, you probably broke a few commandments. If you touch it, thee below, like the navel, bingo, already you're going to cast into the... It starts right in the morning. You scratch yourself below a certain line. Already you're going to be cast into hell. So what's the point of getting out of bed? Look at this, like rules of engagement. Thou trust in the Lord, lean not upon it, be not wise in thine own ways, fear the Lord, honor thy Lord with thy son. You can't do all this all day long. I mean, I dig the thing that it's good and smart, but it's sort of like a long letter from, never mind, I can't say this name. It wouldn't work. You wouldn't understand it. It's a joke that made me laugh, but I don't think it would make you laugh. My son, if thou art become surety for thy neighbor, if thou hast struck thy hands for a stranger, thou art snared by the words of thy mouth. There must have been a talk show host in those days. If thou art snared by the words of thy mouth, thou art caught by the words of thy mouth. Do this now, my son, and deliver thyself. Seeing thou art come into the hand of thy neighbor, go humble thyself and urge thy neighbor. Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thine eyelids. Deliver thyself as a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, and as a bird from the hand of the fowler. Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. You see, that even an ant you could learn from. Did you know that? Did you know that you could learn from an ant? I can. Oh, I knew it all along. That's why I was a young naturalist. I learned that from animals. I liked animals. I studied animals. What is this? There's a lot of good stuff, and you can't remember it all every day. I always liked aphorisms. Even when I was in college, I read the aphorisms of the French writers. They were proverbs. The rich man's wealth is his strong city. The ruin of the poor is their poverty. Duh. Yeah, that's a tough one to figure out. The rich man's wealth is his strong city. The ruin of the poor is their poverty. No kidding. See, the one thing about the Bible that I really like, there's a lot of things I like, but one of it is that they never put down rich people, actually. They understood some are going to get rich and some are going to remain poor. In fact, if I remember one of the pieces in the Bible, it says, I can't ever find it, but it's about the fact that there will always be poor people. See, the communists lied, and they said that if you steal from those who earned it and give it to those who didn't, all will be well on earth. And what they really meant was they were going to steal from everybody and live like kings themselves while driving around in ugly black Soviet cars to their dachas out in the wilderness there, and then make believe they were for the people. They were like Democrats, like a Democrat party. Power to the people, all power to the people, power to the sheeple, schmeeple people. Meanwhile, they took all the money. They took all the women. They had all the fun. And the people just basically, you know, they ate potato skins on a good day. For Easter, they got a potato skin. While the other guys were knocking down the borscht and the herring and the stuffed pig. And the Ukrainian women they had there in the dacha with the vodka. Most of them were drunks in those days. That's the one thing. I think they were guilty underneath it all. But those Russians, you got to hand it to them. They knew how to run a country. They understood that the average person didn't know from nothing, and they didn't give them anything. What are they going to give them for? Well, they have to give it to them. They took it themselves. They were ahead of the curve with regard to the Democrat Party. The ex-Soviet Union was like the Democrat Party's, you know, like wish list. The people have no power. If you don't like them, you can imprison them, put them on the rack, and steal their goods. I mean, that's the dream of Hillary Clinton, let's say, would have a Soviet-style America. Dissidents go to jail. Their assets are seized, and everybody loves her wherever she goes. It's all hail the Clintons. Hail the Clintons. Hail Caesar. Here comes Caesar. Here comes the cigar man. Here comes the cigar man. Burn the Bible. Thou shalt not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people. You want to hear a good one? Here's a good one. Thou shalt not let thy cattle gender with a diverse kind. Ooh. See, that's why we're against bioengineering. We know that something weird's going to come out. Like a half alligator, half man. You'll see James Carville, for example. He was an early test, in my opinion, of this gendering with a diverse kind. Or if you look at half the politicians today, you see that there's already been gendering with a diverse kind. They've already had bioengineering. You look at half the politicians out there, they don't look like humans to you. That's why I gave them animal forms in the political zoo. Ah! Very funny, Mike. So, President Bush releases the turkey. Why doesn't he release the Marines for Thanksgiving? Why doesn't he do it? What's wrong with this man? What part of this does Bush not get? Thou shalt not see the kid in its mother's milk. I always liked that one. That's so evil, man. It's one thing to eat the lamb, but you don't take a kid and say kid. We didn't mean a child. We meant like a young lamb, young goat. And you don't see that in its mother's milk. That's so cruel. Ooh. But there was another reason for it. They didn't care about cruelty that much. They were mean. They were mean guys in those days. You don't even know what mean is. You had to have lived then. I lived then. I remember it very well. And the reason that they wrote this in the Bible in Deuteronomy, thou shalt not see the kid in its mother's milk, is not so much they worried about cruelty, animal cruelty. It was because they didn't want to knock out an entire species. If you cook the kid in its mother's milk, you could kill off the whole species. That's all. They were smart. You see that? It was practical for them. They were practical men. You couldn't eat a vulture. You can't eat a vulture. You couldn't eat a bearded vulture. You couldn't eat the osprey. You couldn't eat the gleed, the falcon, the kite. You couldn't eat a raven. You couldn't eat an ostrich, the nighthawk, and the seamew. You could not eat the little owl and the great horned owl. You could not eat the pelican and the carrion vulture and the cormorant and the stork and the heron. And you could not eat the hoopoe and the bat. And you could not eat all wing-swarming things because they're unclean and they were not eaten. But you could eat the clean wing things, which is how the chicken came around and why the chicken became popular, particularly in Jewish food. I'll be right back.
Savage.
All right. It's the Savage Nation. So you got free porn sites now in America, which have debased an entire nation. But you go back to the Bible, look how far we've fallen. And I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but I'm telling you, we need a pornography ban on the internet. We need porno stores closed. We need the entire porn industry closed down because it's rotted the entire mind of this country. Absolutely rotted out the entire mind, destroyed marriages, destroyed souls. It's probably more corrosive to this nation than you could imagine, far worse than drugs. Look at the Bible. Thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy father's brother, thou blah, blah, blah. Thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of a woman and her daughter. And you go on, it says, or her daughter's daughter to uncover her nakedness. It is lewdness. Did you hear the word lewdness? Now, when have you last heard any of the vermin in the media say, this is too much, it's lewd? Everything they accept, it's all fine. If it feels good, do it. Why not do it in the road? And look where we are today. Look what the Clinton generation has done to this country. You hear? The nakedness of a woman, it's lewdness. Think of the word lewd and what it means. Now you got people going on internet porn sites, showing themselves having sex for free. What does that tell you about a society? It's a demented, ruined society. It's destroyed. People are going to free porn sites where amateurs go on the air, video themselves and let you watch them having sex with a boyfriend or a girlfriend. Now, what does that tell you about a society? Tell me what it tells you about a society. Tell me. Tell me what it tells you about a society. Tell me that you've got people with Stanford MBAs who are glowing about how they've produced these sites. He should be given 50 years in prison. Be made to work cleaning an AIDS ward in Zimbabwe. Now, who created this? Who are these people? Why, they're bright young men without souls. And their mothers are probably proud of them. Steve Hirsch, founder of Vivid Entertainment Group, the largest producer of adult videos. Stephen Paul Jones, unknown figure in the porno world. Who are these people? They're pornographers. And yet they're held up as what, just successful businessmen? Blonde, barrel-chested, and wearing a sport coat, Jones, who's Silicon Valley confidence. According to Hirsch, he mentioned the Stanford MBA repeatedly. Reams of documents and audience data emphasizing the global reach of his porn site. You hear this? So this is the world we're living in. You think this is okay? Do you think it's okay for amateur porn to be broadcast on the internet? Do you think it's good for society to let it all hang out? Do you think it's healthy for society to encourage people to bear their bodies like this? Or do you think pornographers like this should be executed? Like drug dealers, because they're far worse. Rounded up, found, given a trial, and executed. I mean, what do you think about that? Where does this end? I want to know where this ends. Will, Biloxi, Mississippi, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, it's a great honor, sir. You know, a lot of these other talk show hosts stealing your phrases and I guess trying to take your format, trying to boost their ratings, I guess, out of jealousy. I don't know, but I was listening to, unfortunately, the empty golf bag the other day when I was out of town on a trip and don't get you. But Every other word out of his mouth was, make no mistake about it. And to me, that's like that phrase that you always say sticks out the most as a savage.
Well, it's interesting what happens, and I don't think he even knows he's stealing it from me. Because here's what happens, Will. When someone is as compelling as I am in radio, and others will listen, we all listen to each other from time to time. I don't really listen to the golfer anymore. I have nothing against him. We all owe him a great debt. I want to tell you that right now. He opened the door up to a lot of us. Only his day has come and gone. I mean, he's really living on the fumes of his past in the minds of anyone who listens to the guy. But he still does a fairly good job, and I wish him great luck. But he knows that I'm Mozart and he's Salieri. He knows that. So naturally, he listens to my sonatas on a regular basis. I can guarantee it. What happens when you listen to another talk show host is that you subconsciously start to pick up their phrases and their inflection. And that's what's happened to you, Will. That's all. But thank you for the compliments. There's room for all of us. The day that he gives credit to others will be a day that he'll grow as a man, I think. There's nothing wrong with him. He's a good guy. He's done a lot of great work, and he still does. So there's always room for Salieri in this business. However, when Mozart appears, I mean, you got to start. A guy like him has to weep. I would say that he has to weep at night when he hears Mozart playing the talk radio instrument here. So I'll be back. I'm going to do a little more playing on the show when I come back. I got some really, really, really big things to do here. Everyone's traveling. There's no one out there. I mean, the board's full, but normal people are not listening to the show today. You're not normal.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Uh-oh, my sound died on the Savage Nation. Did I lose my sound here? Am I on the air? Welcome to the Savage Nation. I don't have any idea if I'm talking with you or not. I think we lost the connection. We're live. That's good. Nice to hear. We have a fill-in on the board, but you never know. Welcome to the things happen. It's radio. It's radio. It's not canned. I don't have a writer. There's no bright guy who's very ugly who writes for me. It's me. I write for me, and I don't write anything, basically. It's all in my head. Isn't that amazing that I could do this without writing it down? And you look at guys like Letterman, you think they're so smart, or Leno. Without the ugly guy in the back with the curly hair and the large glasses, zip, zero, nothing, nada. Nothing. Nothing there. But ha-ha, hoo-hoo, hee-hee, ho-ho, and all of the politicians go on their shows. Ha-ha, hoo-hoo, hee-hee-hee. They don't know what they're talking about. 1-800-449-8255. MichaelLaSavage.com. I don't know what I want to talk about. I did already the turkey, the dogs. I cried for the soldiers. What do you want me to do now? KNEW, San Francisco. David, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, I wanted to take umbrage with one of the things you mentioned earlier. You said today that you're not getting your normal callers. I am a normal listener, and maybe I'm not normal to most people, but I listen every day. The reason I called, you beat up a lot on the Democrats. I am a Democrat, but you beat up a lot on the Democrats, and I understand why today. You're not advocating going to a single-party system, are you?
That's exactly why I beat up on the Democrats, because they believe only in a single-party system. Take a look at the city we live in, San Francisco. You're telling me this is a two-party town?
No. I wouldn't say that at all.
You have a dictatorship in San Francisco and in California, for that matter, a dictatorship engineered by the illegitimates, frankly, in the newspaper business, like those who run the Chronicle. They're one and the same with the Democrat machine, which is more corrupt than Tammany Hall was in its heyday. But let's say we could disagree on things. We don't want a one-party system. We agree on that. I'll tell you what my biggest problem with the Democrats is, Dave. They promised that they would have the most ethical Congress in history. Remember that when Nancy Pelosi took power?
Yeah, I understand.
Okay. Who are the biggest pork barrel recipients in America's Congress right now?
Today, I would say the senators.
No, sir. Unfortunately for your argument, the biggest recipient by far is Jack Murtha, the Democrat from Pennsylvania who has put a knife in the back of the U.S. Marines. The second biggest is another Democrat. The third biggest is another Democrat. The fourth biggest recipient of pork barrel spending is another Democrat. So all of them came to power by lying to the radical left, saying they were anti-war, when in fact they simply wanted to feed at the trough. Thank you for the call. And that's why I'm glad you listen. Los Angeles, you think San Francisco is sicko. Neil, in Los Angeles, 8:30 on the dial. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Savage. I was just wondering why you think the pornography people should be executed. I mean, that's a little extreme, wouldn't you think?
Well, I don't mean that the people in it. I mean that the purveyors of pornography should face a death sentence for what they've done to the soul of this country.
I can kind of agree. Yeah, they have dropped this country's morals a lot.
You've got people who will have sex with their boyfriend and girlfriend who are going on to amateur porn sites and showing their sex act. Do you think that's the mark of a sane person? And
nope.
a sound person? And moreover, what does it say about our society?
that we're easy and that it's a touchy-feely society. I know...
Touchy-feely? Well, let's move the clock forward 10 years, assuming the country's still here. If we are seeing people having sex on the internet now and they think it's fine, what will be on the internet within 10 years? Go ahead, just project it forward.
Anarchy?
No. Sex with barnyard animals, sex with children, snuff films, and we'll see someone with an MBA from Stanford getting up and doing a pie chart showing you what a good business opportunity it is because they're looking at it in Saudi Arabia? Thanks for the call. No. We need a right-wing revolution in this country to save it. Nothing could save America but an extreme right-wing revolution. Nothing can save it anymore. Nothing. Nothing. Or else we're going to be Venezuela, but worse. In 10 years, this country will be worse than Chavez's Venezuela unless there's a complete right-wing revolution in the political system. That's all there is to it. I truly and absolutely believe every word I just said to you. It's not for effect. Rhoda in San Diego, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hello, Dr. Savage. I wanted to ask you why you put down all vegetarians.
Let me explain why. It's not vegetarianism, per se, that I object to. I object to the sanctimoniousness of most vegetarians.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you have listeners who really love you, myself included, and, you know, I feel like they may be getting help from something like that. Where, you know, if you pigeonhole it, it's like putting them down, too.
Well, but you understand what I just said. I don't actually condemn vegetarianism. I don't particularly practice it. I think it's, you know, an individual choice. It can be done for ethical or moral reasons, whichever you choose. There may be some health benefits, but there are some health deficits as well, by the way. Let's not get carried away and assume that all vegetarianism is healthful. In fact, there's an argument to be made for the contrary. And I could spend hours telling you why so many vegetarians are sickly and anemic, and they're pretty obvious to people. But the fact of the matter is, it's the sanctimoniousness of the vegetarianism that I object to, not the vegetarianism itself. And I hope that explains it. One of my best friends, he was a bodyguard friend of mine. He's a vegetarian, a lacto ovo too, tough as nails, good man. I don't put him down; he'd kill me. And he's not sanctimonious, so it never becomes an issue. He went to the dinner the other night. I had a steak, which I have once a year. Everyone else had to knock off the expensive dish that they could get their hands on because I was paying, joking. He had spaghetti. Excuse me. Sorry for that. You sneeze on the truth. You also sneeze for no reason. That's all. Coming up next is a moderate Muslim named Sheikh Kabbani. Probably one of the most important interviews you will ever hear on the Savage Nation. Something that Media Matters, filled with the left-wing scum created by Hillary Clinton, will not run because they always show a distorted view. And something that the questionable pressure group, CAIR, will never listen to because they don't like moderate Muslims such as Sheikh Kabbani. You see, if they truly liked moderate Islam and moderate Muslims, they would say, wow, Sheikh Kabbani likes Michael Savage? Then maybe we had him wrong. But as you well know, during the 1930s, while Hitler was planning to attack America, he sent out minions and created the German-American Bund. And they went around America saying that Germany means peace. Hitler is a peaceful man. There's no need for you to build up your military. Well, today we have groups like that operating in America under the guise of the ancient order of the German-American Bund. Only they cloak themselves as civil rights groups. One day they will be found out. And they will be properly treated by the United States government for what they are and who they are. Until that day, listen to Sheikh Kabbani and find out who I am.
Savage.
Let's go immediately to an honored guest, a Sheikh Kabbani. I welcome you to the Savage Nation. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Sheikh, I saw you speak today on Fox News Channel, and I was so impressed with your words. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, nor do I want to lead you in any way, but I just want to introduce you. You head up the Islamic Supreme Council of America. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what is that organization What does that body basically do?
That is an educational organization that speaks about anything about Islamic authorities and knowledge and expressions and building bridges with the administration and with different offices, introducing them the real message of Islam, the traditional Islam and the mainstream Islam.
And what impressed me was when you were on Fox, Sheikh, you said that there are 1 billion people on planet Earth who were ascribed to the to Islam, but you said that the a small number, I think you said 500,000, have sort of misinterpreted what Islam is. Isn't that more or less what you said?
Nearly, that's what I said. That there are a majority of Muslims around the world, the 1 billion and something, are peaceful Muslims and following the traditional Islam, but there are very minority that they are inventing for their own purposes and their own interest and benefit a new sect of Islam of the, at the beginning of this century. And it's becoming more developed today, that it was becoming more radical and more violent, of suiting the purposes of these terrorists to use it and cutting and pasting from the Holy Quran or cutting and pasting from the Holy Hadith of Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam.
Cutting and pasting. I like what you mean by that. Of course, other religions have done the same and will continue to do so. I saw an article, Sheikh, in the Telegraph of London, which I read earlier on the Savage Nation, from a person who was a torturer who worked with the Taliban. But he said something interesting, and I would like to read one sentence. He was talking about the rulers called the Taliban, and Mullah Omar in particular. And he said, it's the first time in Afghanistan's history that the lower classes are governing and by force. He said, there are no educated people in this administration, totally backward and illiterate. He said, and although they call themselves mullahs, they have no idea of Islam. Is that a factual statement?
Today, with all this internet access and with all this different movement around the world that they're claiming themselves that they are speaking on behalf of Muslim, now becoming every student or every uneducated person, he read a little bit of Quran or read a little bit of Islamic knowledge, and he consider himself becoming an authority, and he becoming to give verdict and wants to people to follow him and establish for himself a group of people following him.
He said, nowhere does it say men must have beards or women cannot be educated. In fact, the Quran says people must seek education. Is that correct?
The verse that was revealed to Prophet in the Holy Quran was Iqra, means educate yourself and read. The first word in Holy Quran is Iqra, means read. O Prophet, read, learn your people how to read, learn them how to write. And that's why Prophet Muhammad, at the beginning of the time, he asked his companion that who knows how to read and write, let him teach the others how to read and write, because knowledge is very important. And he said, seek knowledge even if it is in China, means if it is afar, wherever the knowledge can exist, go after knowledge and education.
But certainly a modern American Muslim or a modern Muslim in any part of the world would not prohibit women from an education. I think we would agree on that.
It's not only modern Muslim in any part of the world or in America, but Islam in general doesn't prohibit, but it encouraged women to study. And the wife of Prophet was one of the best scholars in her time, and she was teaching all the men in the time of Prophet.
Well, I'm frankly relieved, to be honest with you. I can't say that I'm knowledgeable about Islam. I am not. But the fact of the matter is we're facing individuals who've declared war on America, who have put the statement that they're doing it for Allah. You certainly wouldn't agree with that, would you?
That's the problem. Is it's very easy to say I am doing this for Allah, but he's doing it for the devil, for Satan, not for Allah.
Sheikh, boy, do we need to hear your voice more than ever before. I have a request as one American to you.
Yeah.
I think this could go such a long way to soothing people's fears and uniting the American people of all faiths, even people who are atheists. is it possible that as a major figure for Islam in America, that a Muslim manifesto against this kind of intolerance could be written and published somewhere? Is that in the works?
We have published a lot of articles. We have published a lot of brochures. We have published a lot of papers, and many other organizations in the United States have published already before, since many years, speaking about the religion of Islam, how it is peaceful, and so on. But unfortunately, these things might not be, because the facilities are not so, finance is not so strong. So whatever we can reach, we have already given. But might be many people didn't get these brochures or flyers about the reality.
No, I understand completely. So in other words, your publications already state this. What I'm suggesting, and certainly there's no attempt on my part to coerce anyone to do it, I would think it would be a superb idea for the leading figures of Islam in the world to take a full-page ad in America's major newspapers with such a manifesto. Maybe it would go a long way toward taking some of these young children off the path of violence.
I agree with you. I think that's what nowadays there are many authorities figure around the world, especially from Egypt, especially from Saudi Arabia, and many other countries. They took that initiative and they already produced papers and articles that Islam condemned that, and they spoke and they wrote it as the highest authority in their countries. And it is on the website, on many websites, and it is being circulated in many Arab countries and Muslim countries.
Well, Sheikh, I won't keep you longer, nor will I press you any further. You're probably being deluged with requests because you are the voice of sanity and moderation, frankly, that we need desperately to hear. And I know the strain must be awesome on you right now because there aren't many people speaking out as you are. You're an expert in Islamic law. You hold a law degree in Islamic jurisprudence.
Yeah.
And you are authorized to give fatwas or legal rulings, which is also very important. And you've also written reports on the jihad and things of that nature. But you are an American citizen, and if we ever needed the words of peace, we need them today, Sheikh. And I thank you so much for being a guest on the Savage Nation. A nation, I just want to say, Aleichem Shalom to you.
Thank you. Salam Aleikum.
Savage.
My next guest has written an extraordinary account of an actual double agent Nazi spy who was instrumental in the Allied victory of World War II. He's compiled a never-before-seen account from very secret documents, memoirs, personal accounts. It's called Agent Zigzag, and it's currently available in hardback. Ben McIntyre is on the line with us from London. Ben, are you there?
Hi, Michael. Thanks very much for having me on the program. Looking forward to it.
Well, I've been looking forward to this as well. I'd like to jump right into it. Who is this Agent Zigzag?
Well, Agent Zigzag started life as a petty criminal in Britain. He was, in the 1930s, he became a professional safecracker, essentially. He was from the north of Britain, born in circumstances of great poverty. And he turned to crime very young in life and became a very well-known figure in the demi-monde of wartime Soho. He started off, as I say, with petty crime. He was a pickpocket, he was a con man, he was a notorious philanderer. And by pure chance, he happened to be in prison in Jersey, in the Channel Islands, which are the islands between Britain and France, much closer to France, in 1941. He'd been captured robbing a bank in Edinburgh, and had been caught on Jersey and imprisoned in Jersey. Now, the Channel Islands were the only part of Britain to be successfully invaded by the Nazis during the war. And Chapman was still in prison there when the Nazis took over the islands in 1941. And he effectively volunteered to spy for the Germans. He sent a message to the commandant who was running the prison, and indeed the whole island, and pointed out that as a convicted criminal with a very long criminal record waiting him back in Britain, he would make an ideal spy because he would never be disloyal to the Germans because he would be immediately arrested by the British and locked up. He thought nothing more of this offer because nothing came of it initially, and it was only once he'd been released that he found himself arrested by the Gestapo and taken to an interrogation center in Paris, where he met up with a man called von Gröning. Gröning was a very senior officer in the German Secret Service, and Chapman's offer had, by a very long route, made its way to von Gröning. And von Gröning made an offer to Chapman. He said that if you spy for us, for Germany, we will reward you handsomely. And if you don't, we will kill you. Chapman obviously accepted immediately and was taken to a large house in the west of France, in occupied France, where for the next 6 months he was trained in parachute jumping, in explosives, at which he was pretty adept already, in secret writing, in all the sort of boy's own paper that stuff that sounds almost unbelievable today and was pretty unbelievable then. He was then given a specific mission by von Gröning, which was to parachute into Britain and to blow up a particular factory which was producing the Mosquito bomber, which was a very light, almost entirely made of wood bomber that was wreaking havoc in Germany at the time. And the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, was determined to try and stop production. So Chapman's task was very simply to get inside this factory and blow it up. So at the end of 1941, he was parachuted into Britain, into Cambridgeshire, where he landed in the middle of the night, on a December night, and made his way to a little farmhouse that was nearby, knocked on the door, and the local farmer's wife, rather splendidly in my view, invited him in for a cup of tea, which was kind of a pretty rare thing to do if you just had a parachutist land outside your door. He made contact with the local police and turned himself over to MI5, which is the Internal Secret Service.
It's amazing that he had the foresight to immediately turn himself over to the British. But what was Chapman thinking? Did he have a plan? Do we know anything about the tools he had to work with once on the ground inside enemy lines?
When he landed in the field, in this ploughed field in Cambridgeshire, he had with him a very large rucksack containing a wireless receiver, several packets of chocolate, lots of clean shirts, a revolver, a map, and, crucially, £990 in used British money, which was to get him around the country. So he immediately defected to MI5 and was brought to a little-known interrogation center in Britain, which was then called Camp 020. Now, Camp 020 was the place where all intercepted German spies were taken during the war. Because what Chapman didn't know, and indeed never knew until the truth didn't come out until long after his death, was that the British had been waiting for him. Because unbeknown to him, and indeed unbeknown to the entire German Secret Service, the British had broken the codes, the wireless codes that the Secret Service were using, and these were being decrypted, decoded automatically as soon as they were picked up in Britain. So this meant that because they had picked up all the wireless messages passing between the different Abwehr stations in occupied France, they knew that a spy was landing, they knew what time he was due, they knew exactly what uniform and what kit he would have with him. They even knew the length of his hair because it had been reported over the wireless that he'd recently had a haircut, believe it or not. They even knew what dental work he'd had recently. What they didn't know was his name, his real name, and they didn't know exactly where he was going to land. So it was just as well that Chapman did turn himself in because, in fact, the whole area was covered in policemen waiting for him to land.
Now, is there any possibility that he knew, that the British knew he was coming?
It's not possible that Chapman knew he was expected because the Germans never realized that their codes had been broken. As far as Chapman was concerned, he was landing in virgin territory. And as far as he knew, when he turned himself in, he was a complete surprise to them. In fact, he wasn't. And part of the elaborate spy game that they played was to ensure that he should never realize that they'd been waiting for him. Because if he were to realize that, then the whole secret of having broken the codes would be compromised. So it was absolutely essential that Chapman should never know that the British had been waiting for him. And indeed, the files are fascinating on that subject. They were extraordinarily careful not to give away the secret that they'd broken the codes. So Chapman was taken to Camp 020, where he was interrogated by a man called Robin Tin Eye Stevens, who was known as Tin Eye because he wore a monocle permanently. And he was an absolutely terrifying figure, Tin Eye Stevens, but a very good interrogator. And over the next week, Chapman was subjected to a pretty rigorous interrogation to see if he was telling the truth, at the end of which they concluded that not only was he telling the truth, that he genuinely wanted to work as a double agent for them. Basically, Chapman had said to them, look, if you give me the right materials, I will go back into occupied Germany and I will spy for Britain. This seemed to them to be an absolutely astonishing offer, because here was a man who had a long criminal record behind him, who seemed really to have no one's interests at heart other than his own. And yet, sort of deep within Chapman, there was a good man trying to get out. And as one of his handlers said, he was a man whom only war could invest with any virtue, and that only for the duration. And they concluded that this offer was a genuine one. And so they said, right, we will take on Chapman and we will make him into a double agent, i.e. we will run him against the Germans without the Germans realizing that he's been turned to our side. And at this point, they had to come up with a code name for him. Now, the rule in MI5 is that you cannot have a code name that gives away anything about you, including your personality. But it seems that with Chapman, they couldn't resist the temptation. And so they called him Agent Zigzag. And I can't help thinking that that was partly because they were never absolutely certain whose side he was on. As indeed, I think Chapman himself was never absolutely certain whose side he was on.
But how did Chapman and MI5 trick the Germans into thinking he had done the job he was originally sent to do?
They launched an extraordinary deception plan, which has never been written about before, in which they successfully faked the bombing of the de Havilland aircraft factory. This they did by setting off a huge explosion in the middle of one night and literally draping the area with painted tarpaulins so that it looked from the air as if there had been a huge explosion in the middle of the factory, crippling the thing. Now, they know that this worked, this ruse, because they were still intercepting the messages passing between the Abwehr stations, between the different military intelligence stations in Germany. And so when they intercepted a triumphant message from von Gröning saying, we've received a message from Fritz, which was his German code name, we've received a message from Fritz saying that he's blown up the factory and aerial reconnaissance has proven that he has, the British knew for a fact that they had proven that they had fooled the Germans into thinking that Chapman had done exactly what he was supposed to do. I won't say any more, because the next stage of Chapman's adventures are in some ways even more extraordinary than the first part, because he was, in fact, sent back into occupied France and thereafter into the heart of the German military machine. He was the only spy that we, or indeed any of the Allies, had within the German Secret Service. But I'll say no more.
Okay, we won't press on, but I would like to ask you about the documents that were released once the book was almost completed. You mentioned that these documents are of great importance concerning Chapman's psychological struggle. Were these clinical evaluations?
These were not clinical evaluations, but they were very clever but amateur psychological evaluations. The final file that MI5 produced, literally weeks before we were about to go to press, contained an extraordinary interview that Chapman gave very shortly before he was sent back to occupied France, in which he discusses his own motivation. And they're extraordinarily revealing, because you find a man who is not only wrestling with his conscience, but very clearly wrestling between loyalties, really, because Chapman, indeed, perhaps in common with many thieves in some ways, had a great loyalty to his own criminal crew, really. And in this case, the German handlers, who had been extraordinarily good to Chapman, they had looked after him very well, they'd shown him a respect that he'd never had from anybody else. And it has to be said at this point that Chapman's German spy master, this man von Gröning, was very much not a kind of typical Nazi thug, as we might imagine him. He was a man of great culture and refinement. He was, in fact, an anti-Nazi. He had no time for Hitler at all. But he had provided Chapman with a kind of focus. Chapman's father had basically abandoned him very young, and he was a kind of father figure to Chapman. He played a crucial part in Chapman's life. And you can tell from these psychological profiles that Chapman is absolutely torn between a kind of patriotism and a feeling of loyalty to his own country, about what loyalty means, really. I mean, he was uncertain whether his loyalty should be to his country or to these German handlers who had treated him so well. And in fact, he's very moving about that subject. And he, even though he knows he is going to betray his German friends, he finds it very hard to do. Chapman was a man of many different parts, most of them arguably extremely unpleasant. He was a born, natural-born rogue and criminal, but fighting those elements in his personality were other, far more complicated and indeed very laudable traits. I mean, he was extraordinarily brave. He was prepared to do things that were almost suicidal by any sort of logical standards. And he was also an extraordinarily generous man in lots of ways. He wasn't, in a way that is very odd for a crook, he really wasn't interested in money at all.
Well, what was he interested in? What purpose did he have, and how did that ultimately affect the outcome of World War II?
His work for the British Secret Service certainly was of vital importance to the British war effort. There's no doubt that he provided the Secret Service with a complete picture of how the German Secret Service worked in a way that they had never had before. And in that way, he was absolutely critical to the war effort. He was the only person that we, the Allies, had within the German war machine. And the quality of his information was gold, really. So in that sense, yes, I think he did do an extraordinary amount of good. I don't want to give away what happens in the end of the book, but played a vital part in the closing chapters of the war. And just to give you a hint of it, I mean, one of the reasons why the centre of London was not utterly destroyed by the flying bombs that were sent over in the sort of closing chapters of the war was Chapman, because his final deception programme was highly effective.
Well, look, you've been able to recreate a vital piece of history, and I'd like to know how you began the research process for the book, and how did you go about obtaining the classified MI5 documents?
Well, the character Eddie Chapman, I first came across in an obituary which appeared when he died in 1997, appeared in the Times of London, the newspaper that I work for. And it was such an extraordinary obituary because it had been written based entirely on what Chapman himself had said about his past. And I remember thinking at the time, God, if the truth of that really came out, if we could get hold of the official files from MI6 and MI5, which are the sort of Secret Service files in Britain, what an extraordinary story it must be. And then sure enough, a few years later, in sort of 2001 and 2002, the security services in Britain began to release that information. I began by applying, by sending in a formal application to the government to try and get them to release the rest of the files. They'd released some of them, but there were many more to go. And over the course of a couple of years, they gradually agreed to release all the files. That said, some of the files have been edited. I mean, there are one or two, very few in fact, but one or two sections where certain names have been omitted because the people are still alive, or in some circumstances, some of the information has been removed because it relates to national security. But these are very, very small parts of the overall picture. So basically, almost everything that was known about Chapman during the war appears in these files.
It's an amazing look at history, and it's what our spies should be like. It's important to read these kind of stories because of the intrinsic value they carry, and to show how the internal struggle of one man could change the outcome, not only of a war of countries, but the course of history.
Well, I think that's a very good point. I mean, I think one of the reasons why Chapman ended his life as a very disappointed man, which I think he did, although he himself had risked his life on multiple occasions, he was really never shown the kind of loyalty by his own country that he felt he deserved. There are ways of doing it. I mean, I think it would only have taken a token compensation, and it is true that they did more or less expunge his criminal record. There was never really any public recognition of what he did, and other spies had been recognized. But more than that, I mean, I think what Chapman's lesson, if you like, for sort of modern-day international relations, and perhaps for espionage in general, is that what Chapman managed to do brilliantly was to infiltrate an enemy organization. He managed almost seamlessly to insert himself in a place where you would think he would have stuck out like a sore thumb, but he didn't. He managed to get to the heart of the German intelligence machine without being spotted. And that is something that modern spies and modern intelligence is obviously obsessed with. I mean, the whole issue of Al-Qaeda and so on is about trying to get into closed organizations of a violent and terrorist sort. And in a way, Chapman is a sort of test case for that kind of thing, because the way he did it is quite extraordinary, and it has to do with, in a way, rather old-fashioned things: charm, personality, languages, the ability to get along with lots of people, the ability to dissimulate. I mean, he's become, strangely, a sort of test case, Chapman, for modern espionage.
Absolutely. The book is Agent Zigzag. Ben McIntyre, thank you very much for being on the Savage Nation. Savage. Well, here we go into the last few minutes of this hour on the Savage Nation, and here's something to end it with. Presidential hopeful Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton has published a list of 10 ways that Americans can, quote, address global warming and increase our energy independence on her website. These include replacing incandescent light bulbs with fluorescent ones and wrapping your home's water heater in a blanket. Now, I don't know if they have water heaters on Gulfstream jets, and I do not know what kind of light bulbs they have on campaign jets, but we'll have to look into that and get back to you on the Savage Nation. It says, you can save 1,000 pounds of carbon dioxide each year by wrapping your water heater in an insulation blanket. Here we go again, carbon dioxide. This is below a seventh grade knowledge of atmospheric science. It's below a seventh grade knowledge of carbon dioxide science. It's amazing to me. Other points of advice include turning down the air conditioning. Well, I guess you can do that in the Gulfstream jet. Wind and solar power. I don't know that you could fly on a campaign jet using wind or solar power. I think Al Gore has tried that. And like Icarus, he realized it didn't work. By recycling half of your household waste, does that mean doo-doo? You can save 2,400 pounds of carbon dioxide annually. I'll have to look into that. But now, the Clinton campaign has spent $40 million as of September. They have a fleet of private jets. And we don't understand how that reflects on any of this. The fact of the matter is global warming is a myth. And the other fact of the matter is Al Gore is going to be the wealthiest vice president in history because he has found a platinum mine in the foolishness of people. And as P.T. Barnum said, this way to the egress. According to the New York Post, Clinton once traveled in three different private jets in a single day in May, a Gulfstream 2, a Gulfstream 3, and a Hawker 800. I've been on all of them myself. They're nice planes. A Gulfstream 3 emits 10,000 pounds of CO2 into the air per hour. Well, that would be good for the plants. The animals love CO2. Don't you understand that? The animals exhale carbon dioxide, and the plants inhale or ingest carbon dioxide. That's what makes them grow. So this is good for plant life. Don't you get it?
Savage.